Chapter 17. Michael Collins, strategist. One of the volunteers, to keep his end up, remarked to a fellow prisoner, "Sure, it was a good fight, Mick," and got the reply from Michael Collins. "What do you mean, a good fight? We lost, didn't we?" Michael Collins and the Troubles by Ulick O'Connor. In the famous 1916 Easter Rising, Michael Collins was one of the junior officers in the Irish Volunteers, and in the battle, he proved himself as a fighter and a leader. His comment as he was led into captivity indicates all these qualities, but most significantly, his grasp of the essential focus of strategy, achieving your carefully selected aim. In the years after this event, he would become the towering historic figure in Ireland's War of Independence. In doing so, he was the individual most responsible for the almost incomprehensible defeat of the world's largest empire, and this was accomplished with a few thousand inexperienced but committed fighters led by a small number of able amateurs and military veterans. He pulled all this off before he was 32, shot down by a fellow countryman in Ireland's own civil war. Collins's achievements inspired figures like Nehru, who would go on to lead hundreds of millions in India to their freedom. Collins had also proved to be one of the greatest directors, architects, and operators of an intelligence apparatus that ever lived, one of the main reasons for the success of the Irish. His strength in this field was in some part due to his experience in the secret organization that provided the backbone of the rebels, the Irish Republican Brotherhood. This highly effective group had swiftly recognized his ability and developed his leadership potential in the years before the Rising. As we have seen, such organizations are all too real and have concrete plans, which they don't want your attention drawn to, at least when this doesn't suit their purpose and narrative, which is most of the time. In 1909, when Collins was a teenager working in London, he had been inducted into the highly selective Brotherhood. Personnel from this organization were largely responsible for instigating the 1916 Easter Rising, which came as a surprise to the authorities as well as the nation. This is no easy thing to achieve, as an old friend once told me of a saying, popular with Swedish Hell's Angels, that three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead. Keeping confidences is more than just a useful quality in a conspiratorial outfit. It is vital, hence why well-led ones can operate with little wake left to identify their passing. By the end of the conflict with Britain, Collins would be the penultimate president of the Brotherhood, and one of his closest fellow conspirators would be the general in command of the Irish Army. So, if this small elite of capable collaborators could undermine and humiliate the world's largest empire, why can't others with massive financial resources do similar things? What couldn't such people do if they were even bigger fish than Rhodes? It was a particular aspect of the 20-something's savvy strategic insight that would do for us. The British strategist Sir Basil Liddell Hart stated that if strategy had to be expressed in one word, it would be concentration, as this captures the idea of focusing your combined forces at the most vulnerable point, gaining the most bang for your buck. The Prussians used the term Schwerpunkt, the point of main effort, the center of gravity, to identify this crucial element in any strategy. It was in analyzing and accurately identifying this point that Collins ensured the defeat of Britain, even with the paltry numbers he and his compatriots had to pit against the Empire's arms. What Collins swiftly realized was that the British forces and the small number of active supporters they had in Ireland were almost entirely dependent upon human intelligence, that is, informants, to identify the individuals actively fighting for Ireland's independence. This vital intelligence was largely supplied through Royal Irish Constabulary officers, detectives, and their agents across the country, and the information was fed to a tiny number of highly experienced detectives in the RIC intelligence headquarters in the castle in Dublin. If these few essential assets could be neutralized, especially the handful of veteran detectives, then the British Army and the state's apparatus would lose its database and almost be blinded, largely unable to counter the opposition. Even worse for Britain, the frustrated military and ad hoc forces would often use indiscriminate force and widespread terror tactics to make up for this shortcoming. In so doing, they alienated the Irish people ever more and sped up the process of undermining Britain in the eyes of the world, particularly in the US. This is where his steely focus and resolution became most valuable. He had set up a very wide network of information gatherers, including intelligence analysts, that he had recruited inside the British Intelligence HQ, along with volunteers at many levels in various government departments. These assets fed reams of information to him, and their reports were collated and analysed, along with those from Irish volunteers and other groups around the country, providing Collins with the targeting information he needed. He set up a squad, also known as the 12 Apostles, to assassinate the detectives, British agents and operators sent to counter his activities, with him as their prime target. He authorized the killing of informants around the country, even elderly women where deemed necessary, but he kept a tight grip on his young team to minimize mistakes or the settling of scores. Many times a simple message pushed under the door to tell someone to leave the country would do the trick. Of course, Collins did not win single-handedly, as around the country, thousands of Irish volunteered to take on the occupation forces and to be free of the old Norman yoke. Local units were set up so that attacks could be mounted on remote police and army posts, forcing the Crown forces to centralize in larger barracks in the urban areas. The Irish developed mobile forces, flying columns, based on their brigade areas that covered the patch in which several smaller units operated, and these mobile outfits set out to seek and attack British forces in the field. Tom Barry's personal account of his leadership of the West Cork Flying Column, Guerrilla Days in Ireland, is the most famous chronicle of this aspect of the campaign. His was the largest of the flying columns and almost twice the size of any other. But even so, he commanded just over 100 men. These units were generally manned by carefully selected personnel who attended a week-long course in the field under experienced trainers and commanders, often men who had served in the British Army, as had Barry. He had this to say about training, which emphasizes what I have said about morale and why jihadis saw off the wonderfully equipped and trained forces they opposed in the Afghan hills, as well as in Mogadishu. Many statements have been made by ministers and generals in various countries on the necessity for long periods of training before even an infantry soldier is ready for action. This is utter nonsense when applied to volunteers for guerrilla warfare. After only 1 week of collective training, this flying column of intelligent and courageous fighters was fit to meet an equal number of soldiers from any regular army in the world, and hold its own in battle if not in barrack yard ceremonial. As ever, some were a lot more active than others, and leadership and commitment had everything to do with this. The front line is a small club, even in a freedom-fighting outfit, hence the importance of courage, and Barry very obviously had this and the ability to motivate too, which wasn't so difficult when looking at the Empire as it blindly struck out. By the end of year 1920, the nation was deeply stirred and angry. The British murder campaign had grown steadily, and scores of unarmed members of the IRA and their supporters had been unofficially killed by Crown forces. However, Barry gave credit where it was due when he noted that one British unit in his area of operations never stooped to such behaviour. Skibbereen was garrisoned by several companies of the King's Liverpool Regiment and about 80 black and tans. The military commander was Colonel Hudson, a good type of British officer. up to the time of the departure of the King's Liverpool after the truce, the behaviour of Colonel Hudson, his officers and men, was exemplary in all the circumstances. Such columns as Barry's, combined with the intelligence-disrupting campaign of Collins, did the job. In the end, Britain could not achieve its aim through persuasion or fear, and despite the military presence slowly throttling the IRA's activities, the indiscriminate use of force and violence undermined Britain's standing, especially with Americans. Lloyd George was eventually forced to the negotiating table to agree a truce and the path towards the Ireland we see today. This once again demonstrates the requirement for very deep thinking, analysis, and contemplation before settling on the aim you wish to achieve, the master principles hoped for outcome. Once the decision is made, the real work begins, that of constantly maintaining your focus on your objective. This will become harder with every passing moment and will-sapping incident, and if not chosen wisely in the first place, then disaster looms. Sinn Féin, the IRA, and Collins had massive public support, and he ensured that his forces kept it, even increased it, by calculated, measured, and focused application of military operations and assassinations based on sound intelligence and the courage of the ill-armed fighters and their supporters. And Britain? It lacked leadership of this quality at that time, and the outcome reflected this, even though the forces demanding the continued subjugation of the Irish were considerable and influential. The French experience of their eventual withdrawal from Algeria also shows how such issues can never be resolved without courageous leadership, with the costs on both sides being minimized through tough compromises, often at considerable risk. In the face of assassination attempts and a failed coup by very senior elements of his own military, it was only de Gaulle's personal courage and status that held France together in its withdrawal from Algeria. There are many books available on Collins and his intelligence operations, and they are worth reading. He was too ruthless for some and not enough for others, but war always leaves horror and bad blood in its trail, hence why we must avoid real civil war wherever possible. Today, we have a covert crew aiming at some global utopian and unattainable ideal, using elected officials as their tools to take away our freedoms, to create a world that they think is best for us. However, the golden ticket, your vote, is the vital weapon in our armory, and these can be wielded every time there is an election, aimed and fired in favor of anyone supporting a hybrid democratic future. Collins focused on winning his battles his way, but we have the vote, and our battles can be fought using a cross in the box rather than the handguns the apostles discharged to gain their victory. So use your votes wisely. Back only those pushing for the tools of direct democracy in a hybrid system before you have no chance to do so, and the West cannot be saved. I have found that the best leaders never bother too much with who or how a mistake was caused. They concentrate on fixing it, not finding fault. What do we need to do to get out of this hole? Is the question, not who messed up? Whining and whinging are the fastest way out of a decent unit in the military, but it seems to be the fast track to promotion and riches in many other fields today. Maybe this is why we have hundreds of trillions of fake money and debt hanging over our heads in derivatives, dreamt up by money-mad twerps. Whatever, do not expect the failed leaders we suffer under today to save us. Only you and I can. Collins had one massive advantage on his side. He was on home turf, fighting a hated enemy that had occupied his homeland for over 700 years. His forces, his reserves, included almost the entire population of many parts of the island. Support was not always public because of the consequences for doing so, but inaction itself is significant. When the Dutch revolted against their Spanish overlords in the 16th century, they began their campaign with a few people. These were hired to go around the churches and to destroy the Catholic icons, and this handful of wreckers was unopposed by onlookers, the lack of confrontation telling its own story. Negative indicators can be as significant as positive ones. What is not said is often as important as what is. The freedom given to the wreckers and to Collins and his supporters all indicate the level of backing available to those fighting unpopular powers that be. Some gilded elite may think that their control of the media, for instance, will maintain their popularity, but like many before them, they will find that they have miscalculated, as out-of-touch sections of society do. When the dawn's light finds its way through a crack in their closed minds, they can mull over what people do when they must face crowds looking for justice. When it is time to go, it's time to go. At the flag-lowering ceremony when British forces were pulling out of Ireland, it was pointed out to Collins that he was 7 minutes late for the event. He famously quipped, "You've kept us waiting 700 years. You can have your 7 minutes."